The two major party candidates for Florida governor choose their running mates. Meanwhile, here in Duval County, kids are being shown controversial videos about school shootings. And it's shaping up to be a sunshine law investigation at Jacksonville City Hall. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, they're raring to go. I had to shut them up a minute ago. So we talk about a very busy week in the news with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now. Join us at 549-2937. Then later, don't miss it as music legend Katie Lang talks about her show next week at the Florida Theater. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first, it's Friday and time to talk about a busy week in the news as we welcome Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Regular contributor, blogger Fred Matthews is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. A.G. Gankarski, writing round the clock for Florida politics. Always great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And rounding out our panel, David Cotton, who writes for the Jacksonville Daily Record.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you. And lots to talk about this Friday, everything from these new videos kids in Duval County are being shown about how to react to a shooter on their school campus. There's also a new state attorney investigation looking into members of the Jacksonville City Council. Did someone violate the Sunshine Law? We'll look at that, too. But first, this morning, the state's two major party nominees for governor have announced their picks for lieutenant governor. Congressman Ron DeSantis, the Republican nominee, selected Miami State Representative Jeanette Nunez as his running mate. On the Democratic side, Andrew Gillum chose his former primary rival, Orlando businessman Chris King. Now, DeSantis says Nunez is the first Cuban-American woman to run for lieutenant governor in the state. She was first elected to the Florida House in 2010. King describes himself as a progressive entrepreneur. He founded a company that provides affordable housing to seniors and families in Florida and across the Southeast. So the tickets are set. And by the way, a new poll shows the Florida governor's race in nearly a tie. We are going to begin the hour with a closer look at these two candidates and their starkly different visions for the future of Florida. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. A.G. Gankarski, let's begin with you. Ron DeSantis picking a woman and a Cuban-American woman from South Florida. You can certainly see what he's thinking strategically by making that choice. Meanwhile, Gillum picking a white man from Central Florida, another progressive who walks his talk in terms of providing affordable housing. Two very different tickets as we head into the general election.
Yeah, and it seems like the Republican ticket was driven by electoral concerns. They're wanting to close the margins in Miami-Dade County. Gillum was really strong there in a Democratic primary. DeSantis was strong there, too, but is traditionally a Democratic sinecure. So, you know, that's DeSantis' calculus, basically build up that South Florida Republican vote, bring it home. Speaking of bringing it home, Andrew Gillum, he surprised a lot of people with the Chris King pick. A lot of people are looking for that unity ticket with Gwen Graham. You know, there were whispers that the Graham people were talking about the FBI investigation in the Gillum City, Tallahassee, with donors and the like, off record media. You know, they'd have these kind of conversations. And that sort of put a wedge there that clearly couldn't be papered over. I mean, Chris King's, to me, a quixotic pick because while he's young, he's under 40, you know, he's a white male. He's not Gwen Graham. He didn't do well with Democrats in the primary. He was actually underwater in some polls, more unfavorable than favorable. But, you know, Gillum trusted King. King likes Gillum, and they're going to do kind of a shared ticket thing. I don't know how strong King would be as a lieutenant governor, but the calculus is I like the guy, I pick the guy.
549-2937. Meanwhile, Nunez took some flack as soon as she was announced. Reporters unearthed an old tweet of hers where she trashed President Trump. She supported Marco Rubio in the campaign. So
Trashed is very light language. She during the presidential campaign said that President Trump was a Klansman and used very harsh language to describe the current sitting president of the United States, who Ron DeSantis has strongly
identified himself with.
Ron DeSantis' main campaign was focused on saying, I will bring Trump-style politics to the state of Florida. And Representative Nunez, prior to being picked as his lieutenant governor, had been a sharp critic of the president.
That's right. Now, let me ask you all, though, in the end, does the LG pig matter?
No.
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 Yes.
Oh, one dissent here. Okay.
Yes, I do think the LG pick matters because it gives you an idea of what these campaigns are thinking. It gives you an idea of how they might govern. The fact that DeSantis picked somebody with legislative experience and that Gillum did not suggests two different governing philosophies. Are they going to matter with votes? In a very close race like this is likely to be, the polls have this too close to call, and it's going to be that way, you know, for most of the run. It could matter. So, I mean, we're looking at a 51-49 kind of race. If Nunez can bring home some more votes in Miami-Dade, if King isn't getting it done away, Glenn Graham is getting it, would get it done, then yeah, it does matter.
The lieutenant governor has no responsibilities explicitly in the Constitution. It turned 50 this year. The lieutenant governor position has been around for 50 years now. And during that time, it explicitly says in the state constitution that you are essentially sitting there unless the governor tells you to do something or unless the governor dies, as which happened with Lawton Chiles, or goes to another office, as which happened with Bob Graham. So we had a lieutenant governor become governor for 3 days in the 80s, and we had a lieutenant governor become governor for, 2 months in the late 90s.
You know your history. Yeah, well, let me ask you all as a follow-up. Okay. Two things. One, Andrew Gillum confounded expectations in the primary. Can he do it again in November? Turning out voters that might not vote normally in an off-year election because they're so excited about his candidacy. That's one to watch. Also, can Ron DeSantis turn out his base? And will any issues affecting the president affect Ron DeSantis's popular support? Because for better or for worse, he has lashed himself to Donald Trump.
Well, and the president hasn't had the best week, and that's saying something.
That's putting it mildly, yeah.
Considering, you know, the history of his presidency so far. You could argue that DeSantis did a little bit of a better job expanding his potential base with this pick for LG. I think Chris King is, I guess he would be more to the left of Andrew Gillum. Wasn't a particularly strong candidate during the Democratic primary races. In fact, I know we were joking a couple of times that he's in town, but he's at 2%. I'm not really going out of my way to cover his race. I think for any Republican, it's this whole issue of supporting the president or not supporting the president was going to come up either way. But the tweets that surfaced from 2016, I think they are going to have to deal with that at least for the next couple of weeks for sure. And if I'm Andrew Gillum, that's something I'm certainly going to bring up in a debate.
Well, Gillum will certainly drive turnout on his end, and that's the significant part about this. And of course, we all have to recognize the polls were not on it for this. They didn't call it for this. They didn't see what was happening on the ground level, and that's the big thing here. It would have made a bit of a difference, certainly, if he had picked Glenn Graham for his lieutenant governor, but that simply was not going to happen for a number of reasons. But Gillum on the Democratic side, just like DeSantis on the Republican side, that's what's going to drive the ticket. And look, as winter comes on, the president's going to be inclined to be a snowbird like everybody else. So he's going to spend more time in Florida just because it's warmer here. And we will see him on the hustings. Why? Because this is a race the nation will be watching, and it will be another one of those major bellwethers about his presidency. He cannot afford for DeSantis to lose, and they've got to dig up. This is going to be a dirty race, folks. So if you thought the commercials leading into this were bad, this is going to be simply awful for the next 60 days.
Yeah, so buckle up. Lots of calls, 549-2937 to join us this Friday. Brian is in Marineland. Hey, Brian, good morning.
Hey, well, I sure hope it's not going to be a dirty race, but everything up till now kind of points to that. I, you know, I, I guess you folks know I live in Marineland. Mr. DeSantis has been my representative. You know, he came in a Tea Party wave. He's never really faced a real election. He lives in a gerrymandered district. You know, so he picked out the opportunistic candidate to try and expand his electoral chances. I might add that, you know, I'm seriously, you know, very excited about Andrew. Everything that I've seen and heard up until this point has been positive. He stayed above the fray. He doesn't want to get down in the gutter, and I don't believe he will. And I think his choice with Mr. King was a choice that he believed was the choice of a good man. And, you know, call me a snowflake or whatever, but, I think that Gillum would make a great governor. I'm hoping for the brighter side of politics in this one. I'm really hoping that Mr. Trump doesn't try and set our state on fire. I'm really scared of that. But anyway, listen, you guys have a great day. I appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks, Brian. Andrew.
I think he raises an interesting point, which, again, I don't think lieutenant governors matter. I don't think in a couple of weeks we'll be able to even remember who are the lieutenant governor candidates. By the way,
who can name the current lieutenant governor? Not many people, but yeah, go
Carlos
ahead.
Carlos Lopez Cantera.
Right. I knew you could name him.
But I do think he raises an interesting point, the caller, which is Ron DeSantis chose a blatantly electoral pick, someone who I don't know that on policy issues would align with, but would definitely align with in that she can bring in more votes from South Florida, whereas Andrew Gillum picked someone who is very similar to him. Both Andrew Gillum and Chris King emphasized their campaigns with a lot of religious language. They emphasized their campaign focus on going to churches. They spoke a lot of their personal faith. They're both very progressive. They're the same age. And throughout the campaign, even when they were opponents, they were frequently praising one another. So I think you've got just two opposite views of who to pick. One is saying who helps me the most with an election, and the other was saying who is most aligned with, my current thinking and my campaign style.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at that, the DeSantis pick for LG, I look at how the Miami machine came in behind the DeSantis. Incoming House Speaker Jose Feliz Diaz was one of the early endorsers for DeSantis. Marco Rubio went to bat for Nunez. So, you know, there were real considerations there to be had. Regarding the caller hoping the campaign stays clean, there's not a chance. The Republican oppo machine is shopping so much, you just won't believe. It was shopping before the primary. It's going to be shopping after the primary. If in-state media doesn't pick it up, Breitbart and things like that will. So this is going to be a nasty mudslinging campaign.
We'll hear more about the FBI investigation in Tallahassee that it doesn't directly involve Gillum, but
that and Gillum's family too.
It will come
like
up,
that.
Yes, certainly. Yeah.
And the longer it hangs out there, the more it can be used in a campaign commercial for better or for worse.
More than lieutenant governor, what I'm very interested to see is the attorney general candidates and how that affects turnout. So you have Sean Shaw on the Democratic side and Ashley Moody on the Republican side. Ashley Moody is the daughter of a judge who became one of the youngest circuit judges ever in Florida, elected at a very young age. She was a former Democrat whose family sued Donald Trump. She's now a Republican who's running very much with a somewhat Trumpian stance. And then you have Sean Shaw, who's aiming to be the first African-American attorney general, the son of the first African-American chief justice of the state Supreme Court. If there is a lot of coordination between the campaigns, I think that Andrew Gillum and Sean Shaw and Bill Nelson can each really target their key demographics to increase turnout for African-American voters, to increase for Bill Nelson, the white moderate voters who are willing to cross party lines either way. It'll be interesting to see whether the Florida Democratic Party, which is one of the worst political parties in the country, whether they are capable of organizing a campaign that uses multiple candidates.
Let's see. And by the way, as you just mentioned, Bill Nelson, he's tied in his reelection to the Senate race with Governor Rick Scott. That one is also as tight as a tick.
I mean, considering the fact that Governor Scott has spent, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars on a non-existent primary challenge, And to be that close has got to be concerning for them. I mean, who would have thought there that Bill Nelson would be, quote unquote, the sort of the weak link on that, you know, the top of the Democratic ticket right now. Scott and Nelson, I guess, are supposed to debate at some point. I know JU at some point had scheduled that. That'll be very interesting. But I think to Andrew's point, I think that AG race is going to be more important than people are giving it credit for right now.
Yeah, definitely one to watch. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Roundtable. Join us at 549-2937. Now, also making headlines this week, the Duval County School District is going to show videos to kids in class, teaching them what to do if a shooter were to come to their campus. The district says the videos are grade appropriate and that they tell students if a shooter is on campus, their three options are to run, hide, or fight. Let's take a listen to one excerpt of a video to be shown to kids from kindergarten to second grade.
If a bad guy makes it onto the campus, your teacher will be notified.
Be ready to react when your teacher gives you instructions.
Look for a quiet signal and react by staying calm and listening to your teacher.
Your teacher will check for an exit to find the safest route away from the bad guy.
Be sure to listen and follow your teacher's directions to keep away from danger.
Once your teacher has identified the safest route away from the situation, it is important that you understand and know where to go.
It is also important for you to know the various escape routes, so think of different ways to exit to safety.
Once you know your exit, your teacher will navigate you to safety.
Now, the videos show an assailant dressed all in black walking around a school campus, as well as an armed police officer running into the school. Some parents have expressed alarm about these videos and that they don't think the content is appropriate for young children.
I'm not sure what the attention span is for a six-year-old, but I sort of lost my attention there listening to some of that video. I think it's a little, you know, obviously we don't have the visual in front of us, but just listening to that tells me that, you know, my first grader or my second grader is not really going to be paying attention. Now, we have always had, you know, in schools, you know, drills and bomb drills and all other things. So I don't know if this is something that's, you know, brand new and is quote unquote controversial. I think given the times we live in, though, it's certainly something that parents are probably thinking about a little bit more. I'm not a parent, so, but I do have young nieces who are school age.
I mean, I think about the videos that my kids were shown in elementary school when they were really small, and nothing like this. But unfortunately, as districts grapple with this horror potentially coming into their schools, this is the decision Duval has made. Fred, AG, these were created by the Pinellas County School District, west side of Florida, and then they pulled back from showing them because parents became so upset.
For those of us who are old enough, it sort of harkens back to the Russian Red Threat days when they did basically the same thing. You ran, you got under your desk and hoped for the best.
Nuclear drills.
Nuclear drills that we had, and they released the old black and white videos. I think they're still out there for folks to view. This is harkens back to that. But look, this is what you wanted, folks. This is what many of you wanted. You wanted to make sure the schools were hardening themselves and preparing folks for what's going to be. And the more these drills take place, the more it will become a part of the lives of what's going on. And yes, dealing with death is not a very pleasant subject. But even now, we're in a time frame in which, yes, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds do need to know what to do.
I do think it was wise of the superintendent to delay showing these videos so that parents would have more time to review them, particularly for elementary school age children. I also think that this, in contrast to St. John's County, which I just think St. John's County has been a terrible disgrace, the way that they have refused to allow parents to see the videos either before or after their children have seen them. St. John's County has resisted showing videos. But I'm glad that at least Duval County is giving parents an opportunity to opt out and an opportunity review the videos.
Opt in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you look at these videos, I mean, they're symptomatic of a larger cultural malaise. You know, we see schools' performance and basic skills go down, yet we see security theater keep going up. And I mean, it's been like this for 20 years of ongoing increasing security theater. These parents can't possibly feel safe looking at this video. The video is basically something that you know, his focus group package gets through, it's ignorable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the real issue is that you've got people carrying guns in the street unaccountably, and that's what's happening. You're going to see active shooter things again and again. We saw one in Cleveland just yesterday. You know, how many does it take before we
Cincinnati, you mean?
I mean, the point stands. Like, how many is it going to take before we look at gun laws?
Here's a tweet about this from Julie. School climate is an important part of raising the bar for the emotional health of our students. We need to raise that bar. Counselors, not cops. She links to an article about that. And let's go to some more of your calls. 549-2937. Cindy is in Kingsland, Georgia. Hey, Cindy, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was just calling in regard to the political discussion that you've been having this morning. I'm a Seattleite by birth, but I've been living here in the South now for 32 years. And I think one of the saddest things I'm hearing is that we were keep referring to people with a title. She's Cuban American. He's African American. He's Latino American. It's the first Black American. Why don't we try to concentrate on the person and stop the tagging? I think it's causing a lot of problems in this country. We are all Americans, no matter what color, race, creed. We're all Americans. And I think we need to start concentrating on that, rather than concentrating so much on what your ethnic background is when we're talking about, like, politics or anything else.
Yeah, just Cindy, thanks for that. And let me ask you, while we've got you, there's a really interesting governor's race going on up in Georgia as well. And even though I completely understand your point, demographics are going to play a role in that race.
Right.
You've got an African American female nominee on one side, and
right.
So that's going to come up in Georgia too. You know, and I understand what you're saying,
right.
But what are your thoughts about the race in Georgia?
I really have not been keeping up on it. I've kind of lost my interest in politics since Mr. Trump became president, but that's just my own personal feeling. I'm just frustrated, and it's not just in this, it's just in everything. You're always hearing people refer to someone by their ethnic tag rather than just talk about them.
Okay.
I just think it's kind of sad that we're still doing that.
Thank you, Cindy, for that. Thanks for the call. Up in Kingsland, Georgia, Andrew Pantazzi.
I mean, I think that to ignore someone's background would do a disservice to saying where they have come from, whether it's Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who has a story of being an African-American woman who went to Yale, accrued a lot of student debt, became a tax lawyer, and then eventually the House Minority Leader in the state legislature there, or whether you're talking about Sean Shaw, who is the son of Leander Shaw, who had a practice here in Jacksonville, became the first African-American Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court at a time in the 80s when he was really a trailblazer, and having practiced through many years where African-American lawyers, not that things are resolved now, but particularly then, were really struggling to have clients, to not talk about the background that people have overcame, that have experienced and lived through. I think that there might be a difference in Washington state in terms of demographics, in that it is a much more homogenous state where there just aren't as many African-American or Hispanic people living there. But certainly in a state like Florida, where and in an area like Jacksonville, where we have such a fraught history as well as a fraught present of people having to struggle because of their race and ethnicity. It's important to note that Jeanette Nunez is Cuban American, and what that means for her background and her political views that are informed by the Cuban refugees.
By her life experience,
yeah,
and her parents, grandparents.
That's all
true. And let me also say, people decry all of this as identity politics, but the reality is, in this tribalized, polarized environment, people are now voting their identities.
That's where we are.
Whether you're white, yeah, African-American, whatever your identity is, you are voting that identity.
I mean, demographics matter. That's why districts are gerrymandered. That's why the way, you know, that's why political advertising is the way it is. I mean, it certainly is something that matters, at least to the people who are involved in the campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, we can't overlook it. It is one of those things that are unsaid. I had a beautiful opportunity this past year to travel literally around the state and see these pockets where we are in our place. I mean, the same politics you practice in Quincy is not the same kind of politics you're going to practice in Fort Lauderdale, and not the same kind of politics you're going to practice in the Key West. These candidates, while they have to try to appeal to everybody, they also have to get to the folks who are going to turn out to vote for them. And again, here we are, 2018, and have we ever elected an African-American as governor for the state of Florida?
I think that's why so many supporters of Andrew Gillum are excited about his candidacy, because they see that potential. But lots of calls up on everything we're talking about this Friday. Amy is in Riverside. Hey, Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The reason why I'm calling is about the gun violence issue and things that can be done to stop it. I wanted to make sure that the public is aware that there have been at least two letters sent by activists and clergy to the city council requesting that the city look at closing the gun show loophole, which is a way that a lot of guns get into the wrong hands because people who can't pass background checks use them as a way to obtain firearms. So we've sent at least two letters to city council, and on August 29th, at the city council meeting, Bonnie Hendricks of Women's March spoke before the council, and she questioned President Bowman herself directly and asked him if they were going to respond to the letters. And his response to her was so callous, I would characterize it as contemptuous, and the footage shows it. He refused to answer her question. He was rude to her. And as I think a lot of people know, the council meeting not long after that erupted, and the police cleared out the room.
Right.
Take all the comments offline. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a heated exchange, to say the least. And
yeah. I mean, you can't expect Republican Mayor Lenny Curry or Republican City Council President Aaron Bowman to push for a gun show, to close gun shows in Jacksonville in an election year. They don't want to get challenged from the right. That being said, there is pressure happening. I mean, Senator Audrey Gibson's looking at this. I would expect that any mayoral challenge that is serious to Lenny Curry will take the position that gun shows need to end, because it's a wedge issue that can actually drive up the vote. I just don't know for Republican incumbents that's the starter right now.
Yeah, and that particular council meeting was pretty contentious. I mean, I've only been covering Jacksonville for the last probably year and a half, almost 2 years now, and I've never seen council chambers emptied like that before. I know the president was having some issues with, other council members wanting to ask questions and things like that. I mean, he sort of stopped that precedent that happened under Anna Brochet. So she's not wrong. That was a pretty contentious meeting there, but it's not a problem that they can continue to ignore, at least on the city level.
And you've written about this, AG. Fred, you've talked about this. This energy on the progressive side is growing, and including here in Jacksonville, and it could potentially spark a challenge, as you said, to Mayor Lenny Curry on this issue and others. We keep hearing rumblings of that, but we'll have to see if somebody actually goes ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be a Democrat that challenges him, though.
Right. But it could be a Republican who captures some of this energy around this issue.
A certain former city council president could be hopping into the race.
Yeah, speaking of the city council. speaking of the city council, there's an investigation going on over there. Around
shocking.
Shocking. Around sunshine law violations. Now, of course, Florida's law prohibits members from privately discussing government business, So say two members of the council want to go to have breakfast together at the Fox. They can't talk city business there. That's the basic idea. Now, this all could be related to a squabble between Council President Aaron Bowman and Councilman Garrett Dennis. Each has accused the other of violating the Sunshine Law. We don't know much about the state attorney's investigation into this. beyond what's been publicly noticed.
But here's the thing. I mean, the sunshine issues have creeped up for a couple of years now, dating back to when Anna Broche and John Kressenbitting ran for council president against each other. Broche amassed the pledges needed, but she did so in a way that raised questions about, well, is the sunshine law being violated here? You know, people just kind of fell into place and backed her without discussion. The VP race where Aaron Bowman won, that was even worse. So, you know, we've seen this kind of amass over the last couple of years. You know, Garrett Dennis has accused Aaron Bowman of violating sunshine law and vice versa. And, you know, basically right now, the state attorney's office has to look into it and see what's there. This could be dangerous for people running for re-election, like somebody like Garrett Dennis. If he's admonished in a state attorney's statement, then it very likely could impact whatever he runs for next.
By the way, the unimpeachable Kevin Murchard is reminding us that there was a grand jury investigation into this exact same type of thing on the city council about a decade ago.
Two state attorneys ago.
If you're going to amass votes when you're running for city council president, you got to talk to somebody, right? You got to pass some paper around. But they do magically fall in line when it comes up. So you know it's going to be there. Look, at the crux of this is still Garrett Dennis and his back and forth with the leadership. There's no question about this, but we won't know for sure until or if the state attorney actually comes up with some charge or gets through the questioning process here about this being passed back and forth. And that's really at the crux here. Depending upon this comes out, this could be could hurt Garrett Dennis a bit in his seeking higher office. We don't know. It's becoming a Garrett Dennis 24/7, and Bowman is not necessarily looking to run for mayor, but he is looking to keep
Garrett Dennis, the Cory Booker of the Jacksonville City Council.
But he is looking to keep the cows in the bin through these next 9 months. That's his goal, to keep everything, especially after the Broche era.
Well, I think AG wrote about this when it happened, and it didn't. A lot of people miss this is when these state attorneys, these, you know, assistant state attorneys actually came to a meeting, you know, noticed by Garrett Dennis, who came out and held this sort of meeting where he wanted press to ask him questions about this ongoing squabble with the city council president. And I can tell you, I didn't notice until I read AG's work there. And that certainly raised some eyebrows for me.
Chuck at the Beaches. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, guys. Y'all were talking earlier about identity, whether you're Cuban-American or African-American, et cetera. And I was wondering if your guests could comment.
White American.
Please.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if your guests could please comment on how, and explain to me how Jacksonville, which is fairly conservative and a lot of Republicans, how did we manage to elect a black mayor, Mayor Brown, and how did we manage to elect Sheriff Glover? I believe I voted for both of those men, and I'm a Republican. Could you please explain to me how Jacksonville, I mean, did we look at their identity, or did we look at their ability to do the job? Thank you.
Well, there were races at two different times, but both candidates were benefited from the fighting that was occurring on the opposite side. In the case of Nat Glover, everybody, of course, would certainly agree that he was very well qualified for it. But one of the things that was happening on the Democratic side is that the two Republican candidates were battling toe to toe. There was the turning point in that race was a forum that was held. I call it the old Diamond Head Restaurant on the South Bank there. There was a forum that was taking place, and these guys were acting as if Nat Glover wasn't even in the room. It was covered by all the media. And Nat Glover made one statement. Look, both of these guys work for me, and so vote for me, and we don't have to worry about that.
During that race, the current sheriff at the time, Jim McMillan, stated, this city is not ready for a black sheriff.
Yeah.
And the city—
And some people took that as fighting words.
Yeah. And, I mean, Jim McMillan had promoted Nat Glover to be his— tied with one of the other candidates for being the third in command in that office.
Right.
He was a director. But Sheriff Glover used that very strongly throughout his campaign to say, let's prove that this city
proved
is ready.
It wrong. And people responded to that. And Glover, I think, was a unique figure in Jacksonville politics. That we could talk about that all day.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
with Alvin Brown, of course, what you saw was the white Republican power structure of this city basically throwing all their might behind Brown because they did not want Mike Hogan to be mayor of Jacksonville.
And this was after the two establishment candidates, Audrey Moran and Rick Mullane, knocked each other out in the first election. So you had Mike Hogan, you know, who's playing to the hard right in his remarks. You've got Alvin Brown, who basically Peter Rummel talked to him, opened the doors. The other donors fell in behind him. He still has these donor relationships.
But I think Chuck's point is, I think he takes issue with the notion that people just vote their identity. People do evaluate candidates.
I think we explained the caveats that came into play for these historic votes to happen. They didn't just happen on their own. So, you know, the proposition that, you know, it just happened sort of a deus ex machina, that's ridiculous. There were a lot of things going on behind the scenes.
Right.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about this other story because this is kind of cool. Exploring the final frontier from Jacksonville's west side. Yes, the Jacksonville Aviation Authority has applied for some $8 million in permits to construct an air traffic control tower and spaceport shell for the Cecil Spaceport over on the west side at Cecil Airport. It is the only commercial spaceport in development anywhere on the East Coast and could become the first such facility to launch commercial spacecraft in the United States. David Cotton, this could be operational, first launch in a couple of years.
To infinity and beyond,
yes,
I guess, right?
Yes, exactly.
This is very big for Jacksonville, and it's certainly something that points to where we're going to with spaceflight. It's going to be more commercial, I think. I think we're getting away from strictly NASA-funded exploration, that sort of stuff. There's a lot of companies out there that want to launch satellites. There's a lot of companies out there that want to explore space tourism. One of the goals with Cecil is to hopefully one day be, you know, a spaceport that provides space tourism. This is sort of, I guess, the first step for them in construction. It's going to take a while. I think it's going to take up to 2 years to finally build this thing. But just like everything else over at Cecil Commerce Center and Cecil Airport, I mean, it's just another notch in their belt over there.
Right. And, you know, there's so much interest in this. People are fascinated with the idea that they could literally book a ticket and go into space. Of course, being able to afford that is certainly not within the realm of possibility for most Americans.
Right.
But, you know, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars per person. And so this is a rich man or rich woman's game for now. But, you know, it kind of harkens back to the early days of air travel when people were just astounded that they could get in an airplane and fly across the ocean. I mean, that's where we are now. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, you used to get dressed up. It used to be a big deal, right? Get your cigarette out and enjoy your flight.
And what does this mean for development over on that side of town?
I mean, it just like I said, it's another thing over there. I mean, I feel like every single week we report on something new that's being proposed over there, or, you know, a project that's in development. There's so many warehouses that are going up over there. Amazon has planted their flag over at Cecil. They're building a huge, road to this mega site, this piece of property over there that they can't really get to by road yet, that still has a ton of land that they're going to develop. It's just going to get bigger and bigger over at Cecil.
I think one of the toll roads are going to go that way too, if it's not already open.
So That's right.
You know, what we're seeing really is the emergent 21st century economic vision of Jacksonville. You know, with the port dredging, with Cecil Field on the move, I mean, we're going to see some growth here. We're going to become a center for things. So, you know, if everything plays out well 20, 30 years from now, you know, Cecil Field could be a leader in the sector.
All right, now let's go to Carlos on the south side. Hey, Carlos, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling about a little bit of this identity thing and also even relating it to your topic currently about the new developments on the west side, too. I'm a first generation, born from Colombia, came to the U.S. when I was 10, and went through public school system in New York, became an engineer, got my degree through a lot of hard work. Sisters, both of them engineers. Mom doesn't even speak English very well, broken, but understandable. And not one of us ever identifies ourselves as Colombian Americans. We're Americans. We went the proper way through legal channels, made our way to the U.S., got our citizenships, worked very hard. And on the testing question, they never ask you about Colombian history. They ask you about American history. So all that I care to say is it just seems that these days we emphasize so much on separation instead of that unity. And the crazy part that I see is I see one of the best schools in the country, right downtown in the worst neighborhoods in the area. STEM, very prestigious school with some of the best students that this city has to offer. And they're going to be the future leaders of this country. In the worst part of town, where right down from Rains, where there's shootouts. The crack dealers.
Well, to be clear, there have been school shootings in every possible socioeconomic strata in America, Carlos. You know, I would push back on you to say that Rains is the only kind of high school or school where you see that. I think that's an unfair stereotype.
You have Stanton and you have Rains blocks apart, and there's no shootouts at Stanton. I just believe that when you really take people and you honestly give them education and treat them and show them the right way, all of a sudden they give you their best.
Okay. And I appreciate you calling, Carlos. I appreciate you sharing your perspective on that. Thanks for the call.
And that's a great story of what America is all about. What he has done with his family. The problem that we often run into and that all of us have had to report on or talk about is the fact that it's okay until you run for office, until you offer yourself up publicly. And there is that group of folks, unfortunately, in every community here in Jacksonville who says, I don't want that. I can't stand to see it. I don't want to hear him. I don't want that. I'm afraid he's going to take away, if you're black and get elected to office, one of the first things that used to come up is he's only going to help his people. He's not going to help us. And that is okay as long as you stay away from politics. And that's the unfortunate part of where we are, because people see themselves in their leadership. And if they don't see themselves in their leadership, they get afraid.
Mm-hmm. That is the reality today, unfortunately.
Yeah, and when you look at schools like the caller was mentioning, you know, why is Stanton where it is? Why are the magnet schools where they are? Because, you know, 40 years ago, Duval County had segregated schools. We lost school accreditation. Part of the way to get that accreditation back was to integrate the schools. And that was something that...
And provide educational opportunities to all parts of the city.
Exactly. Right. And that happened in earnest, you know, for a couple of decades. Now we're seeing sort of a resegregation happening gradually. But, you know, that was really a 20th century thing, trying to provide redress and racial integration and increase opportunity.
Yeah. And thanks the only way to get white students to come to the black community was to bring them to Stanton.
And this is the most well-informed panel you will hear anywhere in this city on the history of Jacksonville and our current state of affairs. They had so many good things to say that we are out of time. Thank you so much, Andrew Pantazzi, Fred Matthews, A.G. Gankarski, and David Cotton. Guys, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
In a moment, music legend Katie Lang.
Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. Learn more at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Even by current standards, it's been a wild week in Washington.
If the failing New York Times has an anonymous editorial,
I extend a very warm welcome to Judge Kavanaugh.
The book means nothing. It's a work of fiction.
Heated Supreme Court hearings, an explosive book, and an even more explosive anonymous op-ed. We'll talk about all of this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with long-haul trucker Finn Murphy. He's logged over 1 million miles hauling people's belongings across the country. From up in his truck cab, he can see what's happening in the cars below.
The behavior that people perform inside their vehicles makes it look like they don't think anybody can see. Well, I can see everything.
His memoir is now out in paperback. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Is it a palace coup?
An anonymous editorial. Can you believe it? Anonymous.
An explosive Washington whodunit, a noisy Brett Kavanaugh Q&A, and Bob Woodward drops a political blockbuster. It has been a week, and we'll wrap it all up on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Oh, she just sounds so amazing, doesn't she? Music legend Katie Lang plays the Florida Theater next week. She's touring to support the 25th anniversary of her classic album, Ingenue, and she's re-released it. Now, I spoke with Katie Lang about that album's importance then and now, especially to the LGBT community.
I think because thematically it was so vulnerable that it resonated with people, not just in the LGBTQ community, but for society in general. And then coupled with the fact that I did come out at around that time, I think it marked a type of inner confidence and support for people who were struggling with their orientation or with grappling with LGBTQ issues in general. So it gives me great pride to be able to present the record 25 years later and just check in with the listeners who have had a relationship with the record for 25 years.
25 years. Oh, that makes me feel old. I can't even believe it. That's going to be a great show. Get your tickets now for KD Lang Monday night at the Florida Theater. A few tickets still available. Go to floridatheater.com. All right, finally this hour, don't miss your chance to check out a huge estate sale and auction this Saturday at a unique company that's really taking off in Springfield. Jenna Baker Dennis runs Great Expectations Auction Company, and she's here with the preview of Saturday's big event. Jenna, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to see you. And so this is a huge auction and an estate sale coming up. You know, when people are driving around town and they see a sign for an estate sale, that's always exciting to go see what's available, but this, you're doing a really big thing. This isn't at a private home. Tell us what's going to be happening.
So we are doing an auction. It starts at 11 a.m. and we open at 9 a.m. for preview. What's exciting about it is this combination of multiple estates and consignments that we've gotten over the past month. So it's a huge sale, but we're also super excited because it's the launch of our retail store that's also located there. We have a 5,500 square foot retail store that has antiques, vintage, architectural salvage, decorator items, a little bit of everything. So it'll be the grand opening as well.
And you chose Springfield intentionally.
We did. We actually have two buildings now in Springfield, and we are going under contract today, actually, on our third building.
Three buildings. What are all those buildings for?
So we have four companies that we're running right now out of Springfield. We have the auction company, we have the retail store, and then we also have a real estate company and an auto brokerage.
You're a busy lady.
We are.
Now, are they all in the same block? Are they all together?
So right now, they're all within about 3 to 4 blocks of each other.
Okay.
So.
This is such a cool opportunity because the bargains and the finds I'm hearing are going to be pretty impressive.
They are. So we have a motto that once you buy at auctions and estate sales, you'll never pay retail again.
Yes. So can you give us a hint of just a few of the items people can come and bid on?
Oh, gosh, we have all kinds of fantastic furniture. There's some tools. There's unique photography equipment. We have just anything and everything you can imagine. And for most people that watch our website regularly, they find that even if they're looking for something specific and we don't have it that week, usually within a 30-day period, we get it in.
You know, PBS viewers love our regular program where people bring in and they evaluate stuff they found in their grandma's attic and they don't know what it's worth, you know, and sometimes it turns out to be worth a lot.
Yeah, we do a lot of appraisals, and we've done several volunteer type organization appraisals where we come in and do them for different nonprofit groups. So yeah, if you ever have an item and you're not sure it's what it's worth, bring it by or send us a photo. We're happy to help.
Okay. And real quickly, this is from several different local estate sales that this is all the material comes from?
That's correct.
Wow. Well, there are some pretty interesting estates around this town. So I think it's going to be one that I don't want to miss. Okay. And so everybody needs to come out Saturday to the Great Expectations Auction Company for a huge auction and estate sale starting at 11.
We open the doors at 9 for preview, and then the auction starts at 11.
And this is located, if you've never been to Springfield, at the corner of 9th and Ionia Streets. So come on out and check out the Great Expectations Auction Company. They are on the move in Springfield. Jenna Baker Dennis, a very busy woman, and I can't wait to come see.
Great. We're looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Quorum runs the board. Our theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide program, the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest issues of the week from across the Sunshine State. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening to 89.9 and have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.